I have no relevant financial competing interest to disclose. I do want to point out that, and acknowledge our funders, which are both the Pew Robert Wood Johnson Health Impact Project as well as professorship funds from the University of Washington. And as Ronnie already pointed out, this is a truly a collaborative effort. I am merely the member of the collaboration that gets to stand up in front of the room and talk. I also want to acknowledge that we're not as far along as we anticipated being at this point in time. The EPA originally planned to release the decision that we would be evaluating in March of 2012, then delayed it till August, then September, and now January of 2013. In some ways, that's disappointing for you because we don't have recommendations. For us, it's a relief because we have more time to actually do the project and sleep at night. For people who don't know the other Washington, this is Seattle. Seattle is sandwiched in between Puget Sound to the west, Lake Washington to the east, and the little red Google tag marks downtown Seattle, which is on Elliott Bay. And then down in the southern part of the city is the Duwamish River. The Duwamish River is actually the downstream 10 or 12 miles of a longer river that's about 80 miles and stretches up to the headwaters in the Cascade Mountains. And it drains into Elliott Bay. Now, this is an area that's been occupied by at least white settlers since the 1850s, and this is an area that's been residential since the time of settlers. And basically, you can see these are plat maps right there, right on the Duwamish River. It was a meandering river in a nice flat river valley with an open tidal marsh mouth that drains into what's now called Elliott Bay. So it's an area that historically, long before white settlers, for thousands of years, was occupied by Native American tribes. Now, in the early 1900s, people decided that the river would be much more convenient if it was straight instead of meandering, and thus began a series of projects to straighten the river. And you can see the straight channel that's drawn through the meanders on this figure to the right. They also decided the mouth of the river would be a great place to put the then first, now second largest man-made island in the world, Harbor Island, which is the seat of much of Seattle's port and industry activity. Now, that's the mouth of the Duwamish before the reconstruction, and that's the view at the present time looking across. That's Harbor Island and the West Seattle Bridge. It's a heavily industrialized area, and here you can see just examples. This is the largest concentration zoned and protected to be heavy industry, the largest area within King County. It's where the Seattle port is, too, the main port activity. So this is truly an industrial channel, and many people, both industry and people in Seattle, have the impression that that's all it is. If you actually get down close and look to it, you get a different picture. It doesn't show too well here, but you can see a bridge that's just crossing the river, and then to the left of that in the foreground is a community called South Park. This is a residential community. There's another one on the other side of the bridge, set back a little from the river. It was actually on the river before the river was straightened, called Georgetown. These are two neighborhoods that are predominantly low-income residents, predominantly minority. South Park, for example, is about 40% Asian and about 40% Hispanic. This whole area has a number of problems completely setting aside the river. It has the highest levels of air pollution in the county, where you have the confluence of port activity and all major highways and freeways in the area. There's problems with crime, there's problems with gang activity, there's problems with drugs, highest rates of child asthma hospitalizations in the city, and so on. Now, this is also, even though it's reputed to be an industrial channel by many people, is perhaps not a thriving ecosystem, but definitely a surviving and viable ecosystem. It's commonplace to see shorebirds, including large shorebirds, as well as water mammals. And these are otters, and you can't tell, but that's a harbor seal. And it's pretty routine when I've taken students on tours that you see one or the other. Whoops. This is also a seat, an ongoing seat of culture and ritual and commercial use by three Native American tribes, two of which have treaty-guaranteed fishing rights on the river, one of which operates an ongoing commercial fishing operation for salmon. I should point out that salmon, which are non-resident, they're passing through the river as part of their life, are generally not affected by the contaminants in the river, and it's the resident fish that form that pose the largest health hazard. It's also a site of recreation. This is a kayak tour being led by the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, giving people an opportunity to experience the river. People who live in South Park use the shore. They play on it. They walk their dogs there. It's right contiguous. South Park is right up against the river. And people fish. This is the Spokane Street Bridge. People fish primarily for salmon, but also for resident fish, particularly an uncharacterized and unknown size of subsistence fishing population. There are advisories posted. You basically should eat no resident fish or shellfish from the river. They're considered unsafe to eat. So in 2001, the EPA declared this a Superfund site, which means it's on the list of the most heavily contaminated places in the country. Now, since then, a series of steps have ensued, and building towards evaluations and risk assessment and building towards a cleanup decision to be proposed now in January of 2013. And we're reasonably almost kind of confident it will really happen then. There have been over 40 chemicals that have been identified in the river as exceeding state standards. Of those, based on risk assessment, there are four chemicals or chemical classes that rise to the top as accounting for most of the health burden, and that's PCBs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, arsenic, and dioxins. The EPA has not, and the responsible parties I referred to, have not just let the river sit there. They've identified areas where the highest levels of contamination, have done some remediation efforts already in five particular areas that are marked here. And now as we approach the actual more definitive cleanup, there are four goals that dictate the nature of the cleanup. Now, this is starting to lead into the point that I want you to keep in mind. The idea of doing a health impact assessment on a Superfund decision is a bit counterintuitive for many people, because the whole idea of a Superfund cleanup is to make it safer and healthier. So the question becomes, what is the impact to discuss? And what we'd like to do is make the case that there's a lot to be done. To the best of our knowledge, this is the first health impact assessment or similar activity that's been done on a Superfund decision. We believe there's a continuing role in this. So basically the goal is to protect people who eat seafood, people who otherwise use the river, protect the fish and wildlife, and then the benthic community. And those are basically the little critters that live in the bottom and form the bottom of the food web. The favored plan, after considering a series of plans that were outlined by the responsible parties, who I'll describe, basically involves different possible combinations of dredging, capping in place, and doing so-called natural recovery, or perhaps enhanced natural recovery, letting natural processes take care of the problem. There's also going to be a need for what EPA calls institutional controls, which are social or non-engineered controls to keep people from eating things that are still bad to eat. It's estimated for the plan that EPA probably favors, it would be about $300 million to do the cleanup. The plans that were considered range from lower than that up to $900 million. And basically, it didn't get the river much cleaner. It was just more certain that it would be that clean and stay that clean. And it would take, and here you can see for the favored plan, it's about 7 years of construction to actually do the work, the dredging and capping, and not counting shoreline restoration, and almost another 20 years for the extended recovery. Throughout this time and thereafter, there would be a continuing need for these so-called institutional controls. Now, the people who have to pay for it, and this sets the stage for who we're addressing the HIA to, first off, these are not so much decision makers, although they do play the role in decisions in terms of actually implementing the plan, principal responsible parties. These are the people who historically and currently have contributed the most to the burden in the river. And the river comes from contamination comes from industrial discharge, municipal discharges, combined sewage overflows, and actual sewage system discharges. So three of the PRPs are public agencies, the city, the county, and the port, and then the Boeing company. And then there's an unknown number of other responsible parties which will be resolved somewhere, as we get closer to a plan, and there will be legal struggles to decide who gets to help pay. Now, The cleanup, the decision was made based on the upstream contaminant low, that the river could only be made so clean. And it could not be made as clean as the ambient background in Puget Sound. That's debatable. But we are working pretty much with the decision as it will be proposed, using that target level, but leaving room in our recommendations that if there was so much cost or so much impact from the decision, that if it is technically feasible to go for a cleaner level, they could. However, cleaner rivers cost more money. When you have three public institutions, money that goes for cleanup doesn't go to some other public purpose. So this is a very polarized situation. Now, the river will not be clean. It will not meet minimum standards. It will exceed state standards. It would require a waiver in order to proceed. And they will require these institutional controls. The first ones you see listed here are ones that are basically already being done and hopefully would be done better. Warning signs, advisories. You can see one of the multilingual warning signs there. And then more creative ideas like fish trading. You catch a fish, somehow you give it to somebody, they give you a good fish. So far that isn't real popular. Transportation at locations. You show up at the river, you pile on a shuttle bus, they take you somewhere else. The details have not been worked out. And, other ideas may pop to the surface. So this is where we came in, and we wanted to look at what are the potential health impacts beyond the narrow determinations of health from the quantitative risk assessment, and looking more specifically at the institutional controls as they might be proposed, and getting ideas about what might be doable. We have three target populations that we identified from the start, and they actually helped us to identify another one. And that's the residents of the communities I mentioned, the tribes. Two of the tribes are participating in the HIA. One is basically watching from afar. And then we have the vaguely defined population of subsistence fishers, people who we know fish on the river, but it's hard to figure out where they come from and who they represent, as well as people who are likely to fish in the river in the future, when the river is cleaner. So this is actually part of a larger three-pronged project. If you come back at 4:30 this afternoon to a room somewhere in this hallway, you can hear Lynn talking about the larger project with which this is a piece. One is focusing primarily on research characterizing the cumulative impacts in this community. That's this one here. Another one is an EPA CARE-funded project helping the community to identify priorities for community improvement, and actually looking beyond and separate from Superfund. And then our project, which is focused specifically on the cleanup decision and a related research project we're conducting to get a better handle on who are the people who fish in the river, why do they fish, what are their practices, what do they eat, and how do they decide where to fish. So since we don't have exciting graphs and recommendations to talk about, I want to talk more about challenges we've encountered. And one of them I've identified already, and that's polarization. But there's also been confusion and skepticism, like, why are you doing this? What was wrong with my risk assessment? What is all this other stuff? What does it matter? You can't eat the fish. You can't eat the fish. And unfortunately, that's actually been, other than polarization, has been fairly easy to deal with. Complexity has been our biggest challenge. I've started to allude to that. First off, in terms of trying to put some system on the chaos, we have a number of advisory groups and then advisory amorphous collections, where the ones here you see that have solid lines around them in the upper corner, the residents and the tribal group are two community advisory committees where we have representatives that we meet with. The community is in dashed lines, but basically the community has stated repeatedly they've been studied to death and met to death, and they don't want us to come back and have a public meeting until we're ready to talk about it. And they're happy to let community representatives work with us in the meantime. The fishing community, we're working mostly with community advisors and people who are in key spokespeople for populations and ethnic groups, and particularly that we know are represented among the fishing population. The liaison committee, down in the very hard-to-see purple in the corner, is actually a group that we created to maintain connections with both our decision makers. So in here we have EPA, we have other regulatory agencies, people from the principal responsible parties, which includes the city and the county, and at least a consultant who represents some of the businesses. This includes not just regulators who are involved in the cleanup, but also includes people in the, particularly the municipal agencies that work with the environmental justice side of the cleanup. And then we have technical advisors, who I'll come back to. So the way we started out dealing with skepticism and confusion is HIA 101. Marla Orenstein, our technical advisor, assigned by Pew, paid for by Pew, helped us conduct a training workshop to basically get people thinking about health beyond cancer and to get people thinking about what is a health impact assessment, what possibly could be done. And you can see Aaron Wernham, situated up in the top, paying close attention. We told him there'd be a test at the end, so he was paying very close attention. There was not a test. However, we did generate a laundry list of ideas for things that were be considered screening ideas. Some of them were off the wall, completely unrelated, and some were better. It was a good exercise to get people thinking. Our next meeting that we happen to have, just because it was easier to plan, was the liaison committee, and we weren't really sure what to expect. We anticipated hostility. It actually turned out to be a pretty comfortable working group and quickly worked into a discussion that moved way past cancer to things like gentrification, so-called habitat for people. This was their idea that they came up with. The consultant that represents business at one point during the meeting said, "This is fun. I enjoyed this." And when we actually took this and showed it to our resident committee several weeks later, we put it up and said, "This is what the liaison committee came up with." And there was a pause, and people looked. And one of the members said, "I'm pleasantly surprised." And everybody's heads nodded. So Lynn Gould came up with a more structured exercise for the residents. And this is the good things, bad things exercise, and basically had people work and identify what are good things that could come out of the cleanup during the cleanup, good things that could come out after the cleanup is done, and bad things. Work together, and then as a group, or worked as individuals and in pairs, and as a group, we put up ideas on the board and worked through as a group what we thought were the primary themes. And we were really acting as facilitators or recorders. And this was one of the primary drivers for our scoping activity. And this was one of the more constructive and really more fun things that we've done. It's really worked very well. So out of this comes our pretty picture for scoping, and it identifies the areas that we're currently focusing on our assessment. Different branches of our assessment have moved at different paces. We're actually pretty far along with resident concerns. And the resident concerns focus primarily on both construction impacts, which, as I mentioned, will go on for 7 years in the currently favored plan, and potential opportunities for community revitalization, attention to infrastructure and resources in particular, and as well as gelling of the sense that this is finally coming to an end and it's time to, to restore their community. And then thinking more forward to, well, if the river becomes nice, people are going to continue to move here. It's already gentrifying, and what will happen to the community that's helped live through this and plan the restoration of the river? With working with the tribes and our other advisors, we focused more on fish contamination and sediment contamination, but looking more at broad definitions of health and well-being, particularly from the tribal perspective, meaning what is the impact on sovereignty, self-determination, resources, and ritual uses. It doesn't mean much to have treaty-guaranteed rights to fish in a river if the fish will give you cancer if you eat them, for example. The community group and the tribal group actually pointed out that we were missing a population, and that was industry itself. We had never really thought of them as a community or a population, but eventually came to recognize this is true, even if only if you think in terms of the potential to provide middle-class, blue-collar jobs, as opposed to if the river's made nice and Adobe or Google or whomever comes and puts lovely places by the restored river and creating an entirely different job base. This is what the scoping model really looks like when you go behind the scene, intentionally blurred so you can't read it, but just to let you know that this is for how we keep complexity in our mind, and we have our benchmark and touchstone to make sure we're covering our bases. This is closing in on one just as an example. This is looking more closely at the community revitalization and gentrification section, and from there we have our research questions, which are truly our cornerstones. We continually go back to this, and with Marla Orenstein's advice, we're always thinking, what is our end game? What is it we're trying to, what is it we think we're going to be able to say in summary based on the evidence we've accumulated so far? What do we think our recommendations are shaping up? And don't spend too much time on directions that aren't going to take us where we need to go to answer our questions. So that's complexity. Budget, I can say simply, budget is not enough. You have to do this because you want to. You have to do this because you think it's important for Superfund and other cleanup actions and decision makers to think more broadly about health. And I'd say one of the most challenging but almost kind of epiphany moment challenges has been the issue of uncertainty. So there are some things, I'll come back to uncertainty. We're at the point now, we're now taking our early assessment results back to our advisory committees, and they will have to, I don't know why I have this slide there. Oh, because these are the people who are going to have to pay for it. And this is where we anticipate the, not so much confrontation, but it'll become particularly challenging to deal with what is a reasonable recommendation and what is not. I'll skip over that. I wanted to get to uncertainty, and this is really one of the thoughts I wanted to leave with, where there are some areas where we've identified that in our time frame, we cannot fill the gaps in information. And in some ways, that's disappointing. We're all science trained. We don't like holes. We like to fill holes. But we've come to the realization, in which, you read it, but it takes a while to sink in, that it's enough to identify that it is a problem and that the answers are knowable and that we can provide some information that starts to fill in the holes to prove that it is knowable. And some of the biggest problems we've run into is trying to characterize in a way that's going to be fully persuasive to the decision makers that health is more than just the absence of cancer, particularly for the tribes. We're at the verge, I think, of making a pretty persuasive case. The subsistence fishing population will fill in some of the holes, but we're still not sure who they are and why they do what they do, other than to point out that EPA does not know either, and it's really hard to make a reasonable cleanup decision unless you do, and we have ideas how to do that. And the institutional controls, well, they speak for themselves. I described them to you. And they don't usually run very well when we describe them to people. And a final plug for Lynn's talk today at 4:30, talking about the three-prong project. And that's it. Any questions? Yeah. Yes, and there are parallels. First off, ATSDR has done health assessments on the river or on the communities, looking at issues that are not necessarily exclusively related to the river, and actually as much doing with ambient pollution. In terms of the relationship to the Superfund process, our report is timed to be delivered during the public comment period, which is 60 to 90 days after the proposed decision is released for public comment. DRCC TAG, which is one of our three groups, has an ongoing technical advisory group relationship with EPA. We have the opportunity to continue giving feedback through that mechanism, and EPA has actually been very good at having quarterly stakeholder meetings with the broad group of technical stakeholders as well as trustees and community groups. I think that answered both your questions. Yes?
I'm just curious. It seems like the study all kind of goes through the fish. And I'm just wondering if there's a reason. Is that the biggest impact of having polluted water? Is it the fish? And that's what
yes. Yeah, it works out that the river the cleanup will effectively deal with sediments in terms of contact. So you should be able to walk on the beach, wade in the water, swim in the water. It's still going to be really cold. They can't fix that. But you should be able to do that with no hazard. And the benthic community and the fish and wildlife, particularly with the restoration efforts that are separate from Superfund but part of the whole parcel, should go a long way towards restoring and revitalizing the ecosystem. The big problem in terms of the cleanup is the fish, because they concentrate the pollutants. The pollutants are ordinarily in the sediment. People don't eat dirt, but they do eat fish. And so that's in terms of the direct contaminant exposure, fish and shellfish, the resident fish and shellfish. And these are things that people do eat. You can go down by the river, you know, any time of the year, maybe not necessarily every day, every stretch, and see people fishing. You can see people collecting crabs and clams, I guess they are, I don't know, shellfish. And the and then certainly, the tribes, you know, have the historic precedent that they did fish on this river for resident fish, and they have the treaty guaranteed right to do that. Actually, there's enough awareness now in the local communities that most people in the community, at least the buzz we get, don't fish. And it's mostly people who come there from local nearby areas that we don't really understand. We do know from talking to some people, it's not just this is the closest water body. Some people go there preferentially. There are a variety of reasons. Well, that continues to be true. There are things, actually the cleanup itself is providing some opportunity for job training and there has been funding specifically set aside. DRCC is working to coordinate that, to develop job training for people who can become involved in cleanup, and not just in cleanup, but the other related activities. I made no mention of source controls, because another big part of this is not just cleaning up the river, but stopping the continual flow of crud into the river. And so there is the potential for job creation.
Thank you.